Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Clive Wilson about his new memoir, Time of My Life, a jazz journey from London to New Orleans. I'm happy to welcome jazz trumpeter, writer, and producer Clive Wilson to The Reading Life. When Clive was only 22, he made a pilgrimage from his native England to New Orleans and set about making his life as a musician here. Now he's telling the story of that career in Time of My Life, a jazz journey from London to New Orleans. Clive Wilson, welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thank you.
Now, I'd love it if you'd read for us your first experience of New Orleans jazz, which is in the prologue of this book.
Oh, sure. Okay. I am at a boarding school just south of London, where I have arrived only a few weeks before. I am 13. I walk into a common room at a mid-morning break. Our common room, with its green lockers lining the cream-coloured walls, one for each of us boys, so boring and utilitarian. A cement floor, a billiard table, a table tennis table, is where we went between classes. There's a cheap record player. Whose was it? Did it belong to us? I hear an unusual sound. Someone is playing music I've never heard before. Drawn like a moth to a flame, I cross the room. The record jacket has a drawing, in vivid color, of some place I've never heard of, in a place I'd never thought of. San Jacinto? How do you even pronounce it? New Orleans? Bunk Johnson? What a strange name. What sounds? The instruments, weaving in and out of each other, form a tapestry of sound and rhythm that resonates with something within me, until now unknown, calling forth a range of feelings, strong and joyful, yet plaintive and poignant at the same time. I am not understanding it. I am not making any sense of what I'm hearing. But in that moment, which remains with me today, making sense of my attraction is not important. Something stirs. The music has an intrinsic strength and power that I have not heard before and have really heard anything approaching it since. It is Tishomingo Blues, played by Bunk Johnson and his New Orleans jazz band. His name, Willie Bunk Johnson, and the drawing of San Jacinto Hall in New Orleans on the record cover is irresistible, conjuring up an image of another world, mysterious, unknown, and enticing at the same time. Questions race through my mind. What kind of music is this? Where is New Orleans? Who on earth is Bunk?
And so began a real quest.
That's right. That was really the beginning.
Mm-hmm. You have a line at one of the chapters as an epigraph that a lot of people say that I love so much, that is, I'm not from New Orleans, but I got here as soon as I could. I think a lot of us feel that way, and you seem to, too.
Yeah, I actually heard that at a party a few years ago, and I went, I'll use that.
Right.
Well, I know many people who just came here for a visit and couldn't leave.
Right.
I'm sure we all do.
Or came for Mardi Gras, never left, came for Jazz Fest, stuck around. It's true. Now, you were back and forth at the beginning of your love affair with New Orleans, and you were actually training as a physicist back home.
That's right. I was studying physics.
Which came in handy how?
Well, really, today I don't remember any of it.
Really?
you have to use it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I did have that bachelor's degree, so it was easy to get a job when I was here, you know, later on.
Now, one of the things that comes through in this memoir so beautifully is how hard musicians work and how much they work to educate themselves and in how many ways. So I wonder if you talk a little bit about your education, because it was here and there and self-pursued, really.
Okay. I was here to listen and learn, you know, and never really at that time thought that I would be a professional musician. I always thought of it as a great hobby, an amateur. I didn't even think I would stay here until later. So I was just listening to music 7 nights a week. Preservation Hall and Dixieland Hall was really our front room, because we would just go over there every evening. The Jaffies were very kind and allowed us to come in for free because they knew we were sort of students of the music. Well, being there all the time, we got to know all the musicians extremely well, and they got to know us and would take us around. So in a way, it was an apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how thrilled you were when you were invited to play as part of a band, even to sit in.
Oh, of course, yeah. But I did feel very much out of place in the beginning. I didn't have a clue on really how to play New Orleans style, or even very limited technique on my trumpet at that time. And it was some years later when I started taking formal lessons. But I was taking sort of lessons from New Orleans musicians, informal lessons from New Orleans musicians throughout the 60s. And because of the length of the parades in those days, I mean, we're talking 6 to 8 hours in the summer, in the sun.
Wow.
A lot of the older musicians just had decided they weren't going to do that anymore. And so I got hired occasionally as a substitute. That's how I got to play parades in the 60s, almost right away.
And you learned some valuable lessons, like professionalism, showing up on time, for starters. I mean,
oh, yes. They welcomed me and others like me, but we were expected to, you know, be on time and learn the tunes and play them and everything like that.
And wear your hat.
Yeah, oh,
wear
your suit. Dress properly.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And you also studied with some of the great scholars. I mean, not studied, but knew them and talked with them. And tell us about Dick Allen and Bill Russell.
Oh, yeah. Well, Dick Allen was extremely helpful, of course, because everybody knew him. And he knew all the musicians. And he knew they would call him up every Thursday or Friday and tell him what was going on at the weekend. And then we would just check with him. I was actually living across the street from him on Royal Street.
Oh, handy.
Yeah. So we were good friends. And he would say, oh, there's a funeral tomorrow at such and such a place. And so we'd all go over there in the bus, you know. None of us had a car then, including Dick. He used to take the streetcar. Well, he'd take the Ferret bus up to Tulane, where he worked at the Jazz Archives.
And you worked at the Tulane Library for a time, too.
Yes, I did. Yeah, Dick got me that job. I knew Bob Greenwood, who was the head of the Rare Book Department.
Uh-huh.
And he lived above the A&P on Royal and St. Peter. I mean, it was the French Quarter was a neighborhood in those days. And the shops were all local shops.
Well, tell us about Bill Russell, because he's one of the great New Orleans characters. You know, he's one of those people I wish I could have met and known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Bill was a true eccentric, a collector of everything under the sun connected with the music and the musicians. And he had it all in boxes. You know, one box would be labeled George Lewis and another one Lee Collins or baby Dodds or, you know. Mm-hmm. And so everything pertaining to that person was, he knew exactly where it was. If you walked into his apartment, you'd think he was a hoarder, because these boxes were laid about all over the floor and tables and chairs and impossible, you know, but he knew where everything was.
But this was before the days of computer, when paper was the way to go. I mean, what else could he do with all that stuff?
Exactly. And he'd been keeping it since he began being interested mm-hmm. in New Orleans musicians when he was living in Chicago.
And we owe him a real debt for mm-hmm. that. Now, one of the things that you do so wonderfully in this book is give us little portraits all along the way of musicians who meant a lot to you, people like Punch Miller, George Gaynor, Kid Howard, Percy Humphrey. So talk a little bit about those guys.
As I said, we got to know them really because they'd see us every night. Or mm-hmm. if they were playing twice a week, we'd see them twice a week anyway. So it was very easy to approach them, and they were very friendly. As you know, New Orleans people in general are very friendly, and they still are. And they were extremely friendly in the 1960s. So we would say, well, look, can I come by your house on such and such a day? And they'd say, oh, yes, come on over. And you know, I give lessons or whatever. And I would know them not just when they were playing, but also in their house, you know, with their families.
Right.
I could see the whole way of life, you might say, of people like that who lived here.
And you said kind of indirectly that you felt they accepted you because you were British. In a different way, of course.
Yeah.
And you were not the only immigrant musician here at that time, you know?
No. We were accepted extraordinarily well, but partly because we came from another environment where there was no record of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
The Civil Rights Act had just been passed in 1964, so it was legal, finally, for us to go and see them in their homes and mix without having to have a special police pass or anything like that. So they welcomed us because obviously we were without prejudice and we could just get along, you know, as like neighbors, you know.
Who was your most important teacher, do you think?
Oh, in those days, I was imitating a lot of different people in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
So it's hard to say. My favorite was Kid Howard, who was, I didn't have any lessons from. He refused. But he cooked up a wonderful dinner for me once. But he was one of the most, exciting trumpet players to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But the one who really took me under his wing was Alvin Alcorn.
Uh-huh.
And Alvin would do that with all visiting musicians and also the young musicians coming up. They could go over to his house and his wife would, you know, cook him a dinner and he'd chat about stuff. But he would show me stuff on the trumpet.
You write a lot about the dynamics of a band, too. You played with the original Tuxedo Brass Band and Papa French's original Tuxedo Brass Band. And at one point you assembled your own band, the original Camellia Jazz Band.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about those responsibilities of, you know, being part of a group and leading a group.
When I came back to New Orleans permanently in 1970, work had expanded considerably. Bourbon Street, for example, had 7 clubs with, quote, Dixieland mm-hmm. or traditional jazz bands in them, sometimes 2 a day. The hours were long, you know, and all that, but it was steady work. And once again, because I was younger, I would tend to get those jobs. And because the long hours, the older musicians didn't want to play 6 hours. And that's what it was at first. It's come down to 5 these days. And so I would play up and down the street, you know, quite a lot. And I was playing particularly with Dave Fatman Williams in the Maison Bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we also played his compositions, which included I Ate Up the Apple Tree.
Uh-huh.
Well, I had a sort of record company, you know, it's an independent record company called New Orleans Records. And so I said, Dave, we need to publish these tunes. They need to be, you know, legal so you can get royalties. And we'll need to record them. So he said, yeah, let's do it. We had been playing them on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fairly easy to do. And that was the first time I published, well, actually the only time I published anything, but I published all his songs.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm still paying royalties to his family.
Fantastic.
You know. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that's a New Orleans classic. Everybody knows that song.
Yeah, then initially we took it around to the radio stations and he started to get known a little bit around town as mm-hmm. the Apple Tree Man because they'd played every Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm.
That was during the 1970s. Subsequently, several people have recorded it because they just like it, you know, like Dr. John
uh-huh.
and the Dirty Dozen and Kermit Ruffins and a few others.
It's just a fun song, you know. It's fun to hear. I'm sure it's fun to play.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
One of the kind of threads in this memoir is your search for your own sound and your search for a musical soul. And you're sort of looking at that in other people and assessing how it comes about.
That's right. But I can talk about that. When I started playing, I was trying to play, you know, like New Orleans musicians. The only way I could sort of do it was to imitate what I'd heard, mm-hmm. you know. Well, that's all very well. They were kind of flattered by people imitating them. But in the long run, you have to have your own style because all the musicians I heard played their own style. Not one sounded like another. Yeah. And you can even check that out today. Nobody plays like anybody else. They all have their own style. So I knew I had to get my own style, which took time. There was a time when I was really under Alvin Alcorn's
influence
and wing and friendship and everything, that I just couldn't stop playing like him. I mean, it mm-hmm. was really almost embarrassing, but it was okay. It was a really good experience. But gradually over the years, I formed my own style because you just can't remember everything you're imitating as a beginner.
Uh-huh.
And so you form your own style, and that's it just comes with time.
Well, how would you describe your style? You look horrified.
I have no idea how I would describe it, really. It's not as primitive as the people I started out mm-hmm. listening to. It's more like a later generation. It's a bit more like Thomas Jefferson and Alvin Alcorn
uh-huh.
than, say, Kid Thomas and Dee Dee Pierce.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So what was your most memorable performance? What was the most fun section of this to write for you?
The most fun section? I think actually the La Dolce Vita, which is my interactions with Barbara Reed.
Uh-huh.
That really hasn't been done before at all. And
a great New Orleans character, for sure.
Yeah, I would say that's probably my most fun. And trying to put it all together into a sort of, to make sense of it as a story.
A narrative, you're
a
right.
A narrative.
So tell us a little bit about who she was and what she did.
Well, she was fascinated with New Orleans jazz when she was living in Chicago. And there were a lot of New Orleans jazz musicians who lived up there. And she loved that traditional jazz way of doing things. And then there was Bill Russell was living there, and she became very involved by being his assistant and helped him sell records and also helped him by going on the road with him. When he took Mahalia Jackson on the road,
uh-huh.
He was the first guy to promote Mahalia Jackson, which is just amazing. He wasn't just involved with mm-hmm. New Orleans jazz musicians, although she did come from New Orleans.
Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. So I think it just overwhelmed her. And she moved here in the early 50s and lived in the French Quarter and went around and got to know all the musicians and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and continued with that, but she didn't do any recordings of her own at that time. She had recorded a few things with Bill Russell's help in Chicago, but then, along with some others, who formed a society to take a lease from Larry Borenstein,
right,
in the French Quarter, and open a club. Well, it's not really like a club, but anyway, it was a place where the musicians could play. And they put a kitty on the door, and I think it was a dollar admission in those days. And that was just to pay the musicians and pay the lease. Then they were looking for a name right on from the very beginning. And Slowdrag Pavageau, the bass player, came up with a name. He said, "Well, Barbara, if you want to preserve music, why don't you call it Preservation Hall?" So they did.
Oh, I know. That's a great story. And Slow Drag is one of my favorite New Orleans names ever, you know.
Yeah, we just called him Drag for short, you know. When he was young, he had made a name of being a good dancer. Mm-hmm. And the Slow Drag comes from the fact that he was a good Slow Drag dancer, whatever that is.
You get this real sense of musicians as a community, the French Quarter as a community. It really comes alive in this memoir. But you really end on this sense of change and that there's an end to this kind of music, and you don't seem to feel that new musicians are rising to replace others.
I mean, well, you know, musicians are rising, but they haven't heard what we heard.
Uh-huh.
They haven't heard the way the music was played in the, in my case, the 1960s. So all I can say really is that they have their own style, but it's not the same music. And they need to get their own style. Well, the music that I heard lives on in my memory, mm-hmm, and in a few other people like me. When we go, the memory will be gone. We'll have jazz, we'll have music, we'll have exciting stuff going on in New Orleans, but it won't be the same. That's all I can say.
Uh-huh. Now, I wonder if you'd like to say a few words about Louis Armstrong, whose music was also so important to you.
Well, there's the quintessential New Orleans musician.
Yep.
When he was young, I know he was probably imitating a lot of people, but he also had an instinct for harmony and melody because he had been, before he played trumpet, he was singing, mm-hmm, on the street, yes, in a barbershop style quartet, I would assume. But what happened with him, he is so talented that he could play like anybody but play better than them. So, of course,
right,
naturally, very soon he had his own style, but he could play better than anybody else.
Well, every trumpeter plays in his shadow in a way, you know.
Oh, yes.
We've been talking with Clive Wilson, whose new book is Time of My Life, A Jazz Journey from London to New Orleans. Clive, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan.
So let's hear a little bit of Albert Papa French, A Tradition Hall, featuring Clive Wilson on Go to New Orleans. This is from Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week here in New Orleans. Agnes Gomillion discusses and signs The Record Keeper, Sunday, July 14th at 2 at Octavia Books. Jesse Morgan Owens discusses and signs Girl in Black and White, the story of Mary Margaret Williams and the abolition movement, Sunday, July 14th at 2 at the Smith Branch of the New Orleans Public Library. Volunteer with Louisiana Books to Prisoners when they hold a work night for volunteers, Sunday, July 14th from 4 to 7 at 2523 George Nick Connor Drive, open to anyone. Chris Lackey discusses and signs his mystery, Greasy Bend, Tuesday, July 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Pelican Publishing Company presents Meet the Pelican Authors at the Summer Children's Series, Wednesday, July 17th at 9:30 a.m. at Clearview Mall in the Target Wing. Authors appearing include Cecilia Casserole-D'Artez, author of the Jenny Giraffe series, Alex McConduit, author of Snowballs for All, Mike Strecker, author of Jokes for Crescent City Kids, Gary Olipio, author of Craziest Fishing Tale on the Bayou, Kathleen Schrenk, author of A Dog Steals Home, and Laura Joan, author of Hurricane Boy, and Bayou Boogeyman presents Hoodoo and Voodoo. The Historic New Orleans Collection Art of the City Book Club continues with a discussion of Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas, featuring co-editor Rebecca Snedeker and exhibit curator Jan Gilbert. I'll facilitate the discussion Wednesday, July 17th at 6 at 520 Royal Street. Free, but register at hnoc.org. Megan Burns, Tom Andes, and Todd Cirillo are the featured readers at the Bloodjet Poetry Series, Wednesday, July 17th at 7:30 at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Dogfish presents Kimberly Ann Southwick and Andy Young, Thursday, July 18th at 7 at 2448 North Villery. Four local authors, Carolyn Levy, author of Regina, Renee Uzi, author of Yellowjack, Cherie Cohen, author of Ghost Trippin', and Pam Villagran, author of Petite Rose, talk about their new novels Thursday, July 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Visible Empire by Hannah Pittard, Saturday, July 20th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Artist Book Collection at Paper Machine, Crescent City Books and Letters Red present an open mic night for book nerds. Codex is a conversation about the physicality and context of interacting with books and using them. Attendees are encouraged to bring any book they'd like to share. There will be loads of conversation about the interaction with books and what books are. In the interest of time, the first 10 book nerds who arrive and sign in to share their book or books will get 10 minutes to do so in this session. The event takes place Saturday, July 20th at 6 at Crescent City Books, 124 Barone Street. And coming up, Colson Whitehead discusses his new novel, The Nickel Boys, Wednesday, July 24th at 7 at Loyola University's Roussel Hall. This is a ticketed event, tickets available at Garden District Bookshop. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.